Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss, Brothers Wiss. The Brothers Wiss. The Brothers.
You're now listening to Greg.
It's Hello, everybody. Wiss. This is Greg Soul with the Brothers Wiss number 62. Greg Soul out of Texas. Be jealous, people. And we also today have Mike Hammett out of Chicagoland. How's it going, brother?
Not too bad. It's nice to get some warmer temperatures. Nice and not so nice. It's difficult to do outdoor work, obviously, when it's cold. But on my links where I have thermal fading, thermal inversions happening, they seem to happen between like 10 and like 70 degrees.
That's a pretty big range.
Yeah. So if it's cold, like, it's fine. Well, maybe 20. But like, if it's cold, then it's like, it's rock solid. You know, there's no interference, getting full signal. Things are great. If it goes above that much, kind of goes to hell. And I just wish there was easier ways of figuring out that thermal inversion stuff. It's just, you know, WISP for 14 years, and then I've had much longer links, and I don't know.
It's time to move. Apparently that's what it is.
When there's no wind. So it has to be in that temperature range and no wind. If there's wind, it's fine.
Interesting.
I need another tower in the middle on that link, but getting one's difficult.
Get off your butt. You can do it. Don't let your dreams be dreams, Mike. All right.
Dream a little, dream with me.
No, that's okay. let's jump right in. We had a couple of interesting tidbits this week. Not a ton of stuff on here. I guess mostly we'll be just blah, blah, blahing like normal. One I thought that was really interesting was Google devices disrupting home Wi-Fi. There was a couple of different articles. I think I saw one for TP-Link put it out, and then The Verge picked up on some of the information and issued a little additional stuff on it. So basically what happens is if you're using a Google Cast product, like a Chromecast, and I think they have like a speaker. I think it's Google Home Max speaker or something like that. They found that clients, what they'll do is they will go to sleep, and then they'll save up all of these messages, and then when they finally come out of sleep mode, they'll dump them all at once. And they're saying that it could exceed over 100,000 packets trying to send instantaneously, which will tip over a lot of home devices, which I thought was pretty funny. Not funny. Yeah, but funny.
Yeah, that's gonna be a problem in most any home setting.
Yeah. So Google says it's working quickly to share a solution, but they don't have anything out yet. So hopefully they'll come out with something. We had a question: was what do you do to protect yourself against that? You have any advice there, Mikey?
Don't have a Chromecast or Google Home.
Well, I was thinking about it. If you're on a switch network, you could do storm control. Right, that's pretty common in most switches, where it'll look at say unicast stream or broadcast traffic or multicast traffic, and you can set a threshold, like a rising threshold. Once it goes beyond a certain number of packets per second, it will suppress all of those. And in some instances, I think with storm control, you can have the action be fairly aggressive and actually like shut the port down, things like that. But what if you're just on a wireless network? I mean, what recourse do you have?
Like a multi-band, you know, solution would, you know, should help that, because you're not, you know, you're either going to ruin one band, you know, unless you have, you know, I don't know. I assume these are all dual band capable devices.
Well, I know like my old Chromecast just runs in the 2.4.
Oh, okay. Yeah, I have a Chromecast. I just don't remember because I haven't used it in couple of years.
Oh, you're chump. I use it all the time.
I just got a laptop. and then plugged that in because I wanted to watch Amazon Video, which wasn't available on the Chromecast or most of the Chromecast devices unless you just streamed your Chrome browser. I'm like, well, that looks like crap. So I just plugged the laptop screen
to the TV. I was thinking about it, so I don't really know that there are any mechanisms. If you're on a wireless network and a wireless client wants to send 100,000 messages, he's going to do it. And he's going to put it on the wire and every client's going to hear it. So it should congest whatever that frequency is for a minute, you know, whatever channel is. I think it's, from my understanding and from some of the reading, it sounds like that many packets is actually tipping over some of the kind of home access points. So it's like locking them up. So it's not just that there's a ton of congestion all of a sudden. It's that the router can't handle it and it's tipping over and you got to reboot the guy. So that's unfortunate.
Don't buy crap devices.
Well, I mean, you know, it's like with the meltdown. It's like saying don't buy crap processors. Well, you know, I mean, it's pretty much in everything. Then everybody's using it in virtually every... I mean, I haven't run an AMD processor in forever. I know you do, but I've got Intel in all of my servers and all of my laptops, all of my workstations, unless it's something small, and I guess it has like an ARM CPU or something like that. But, right, it's like you can't account for everything. You know, you can't plan for all this stuff. They apparently have a fix in the works, but it's not there yet. I think it's interesting. So how do you protect yourself against this over... wireless? I don't think you can, because you'd have to physically stop that individual client from sending all those packets, and there's nothing you can do. So even if you try and, I don't know, disassociate that client or something like that, if it can't get out to him quick enough, I guess he's just going to spew it out. I mean, and everybody else is going to hear it too, right? Because it's a broadcast medium, so everybody hears all that wireless stuff. I don't know. Seems like a bad situation you can't really do a lot about.
So I suppose multi bands and just kind of segregate those types of things out of separate bands. Multi-user MIMO, once that becomes more prevalent, that could help mitigate it, assuming there's sufficient controls on the app. But then, you know, that's an end-to-end solution. You know, it doesn't let you know your multi-user MIMO access point doesn't use multi-user mode if there's, you know, if it's not supporting multi-user MIMO clients.
Gotcha. I don't even think segregating frequencies is going to help this, because like with Chromecast, you know, like even if your Chromecast is on 2.4, your client, like your laptop's probably going to be on the 5 gigahertz stuff. So, you know, it's kind of trash both of them. And I think ultimately it's that it's tipping over the clients, or rather it's tipping over the access points. So just build beefier access points or get you a bigger access point. That's all you can really do in that scenario.
I wonder if anyone, well, I guess I could probably look for one of my Chromecasts and maybe I could do a test with you know, some MikroTik access points of various styles. You know, because I know that like, your standard MikroTik is a lot more capable than most home access points, you know, but on what scale of MikroTik do you need to be capable of that? You know, is the half, is, you know, is the full half AC, is that good enough to handle that? You know, or is it not just, you know, CPU power, you know, in the access point? You
well,
know, they
I think
handle
if you're,
pretty good packets per second.
Yeah, I think a MikroTik or probably even a UniFi would be able to absorb that. I mean, it may stop forwarding traffic while that's going on. You know, I mean, say it gets overrun or whatever, but I don't think it's going to lock up the device. I think as soon as the flood is over, it'll just pick right up where it left off.
Which I suppose that kind of puts another, you know, reason to do, you know, managed, you know, managed Wi-Fi type services, where you know, where you're in charge of the access point in the client's home, and where is the HAP AC? I'm trying to find it on their website. Oh, there it is. It's cost more than I thought it would.
It's pricey.
And you know, then you have control over the kind of access points that go out, you know, that your clients are using. You know, it's a big trade-off. You know, now you're more involved in the, you know, client's network. But like, you're looking here at what it, on MikeDick's website, they've changed their product pages. There's little tabs now, specifications, downloads, galleries, test. Looking here, the HAP AC routing mode, fast path, you know, even on the 64 byte pack, loop 397,000 packets a second. So if it were to dump 100,000 packets, I would just, HAP AC could just chew through that.
It could absorb that. Yeah. So get better access points.
Yeah. It's kind of like Tom's, buy bigger routers. Even the little guy, even the $19 HAP Mini, routing, fast path, 386,000 packets a second. You know, it has some simple queues. It's still 151,000 packets per second. That's $20.
There you go.
So
even if you, cut that in half for marketing purposes, that's still a lot of packets it can handle.
Yeah. I would suspect then that the router wouldn't crash, you know, if you're using a microtip type router, it wouldn't crash, and you probably wouldn't even notice it.
That's cool.
Because it's not going to be, I doubt it's going to be, but like it just dumps 100,000 packets roughly, it then just goes back to normal. So if it doesn't sustain it, then it should be able to just eat that up and keep moving.
Yeah, that's cool. All right, so moving on to other kind of hardware-based questions. You linked up FCC application for the Ubiquiti Unified Dimmers. What do you think about that, Mikey?
I have to separate from Beta Forum, because you can't talk about Beta Forum outside of Beta Forum, despite everybody doing it. Figure I should lead a good example, and say I don't know much about it other than what's in the FCC documentation.
Gotcha. So it looks like some kind of, and I don't have beta access, so I'm going to speculate. It looks like kind of like a light dimmer associated with Unified. Does that seem like what it might be to you? Which I think is interesting. Sort of in the vein of their MFI stuff that came and went for a while there.
I only know of the words dimmer being applied to lights and people. and I'm assuming it's to the lights. There are no unified lights.
Yet.
So there must be a unified light. Because why else would they have a dimmer?
I don't know. That's interesting.
And
it's a new, different direction.
Their MFI went a couple different directions when they had it. You know, it had some more, home end user stuff, and had some more, industrial type stuff. Industrial maybe a little bit too strong, but not your average home user anyway. Maybe enthusiast. Or, commercial.
Just trying to think it through, the concept of dimmer. If you have a dimmer on a light switch, that means you have control of that light switch in some way. And so maybe this is kind of ties into more of a building automation, because Unify, it's like I'm going to control the access points, the switches, the gateway, kind of the firewall, and maybe to some extent the VoIP. So you could start rolling in some kind of building automation into this as well. So you could do dimmers and maybe kind of go after Nest with a thermostat sort of thing. Maybe you could do, a lot of HVAC systems are distributed. They have distributed thermostats, and maybe you could replace them with this sort of thing. That way you could do some automated, you know, after hours, it cuts down the temperature to X. And then, you know, during hours, you know, or, you know, 2 hours before people are expected or anticipated, it'll bring up the temperature and, you know, turn the lights back on and maybe sense people, occupancy, stuff like that. So, I mean, it's an interesting concept. I could see them kind of stretching. I mean, it sort of feels like maybe it's in the same vein of the Unify stuff-ish. I don't know. I could sort of see things go in that direction for them. That's not a terrible idea, I don't think. I could see it working.
And, you know, I've been hearing a lot about, you know, people doing, you know, PoE lighting. So that, you know, PoE, now it's in Ubiquiti's wheelhouse. You know, they do everything over PoE now. So, you know, this could have some pretty far reaching, you know, in the big picture, you know, they could do all kinds of stuff. I guess it just depends upon their level of commitment.
That's interesting. Yeah, when you're talking about PoE lighting too, I've read a little bit more about that as well myself. It's an interesting concept. When you're using low voltage cable, you don't have to have electricians drop that stuff in there anymore, right? So if you're just running Ethernet or any other kind of low voltage, any schmuck can drop that in. And if you're PoE powering it, that's kind of an interesting concept as well. I don't know if you'd want to burn an expensive port for that, but I don't know. Maybe you'd see another very inexpensive device made to aggregate these lights or something. Who knows?
For that, I mean, you know, you don't need your you know, PoE switch. You know, you don't need it to handle, you know, you don't need non-blocking backplanes because they're light bulbs.
Yeah.
You know, you can get just the cheapest chipset you can find and stuck it, you know, well, as long as it's reliable. And
maybe stick they'll it in there. Maybe they'll build a Unify AP that's just got a big monster LED light array built into it. And it's all in one, man. Then you got it. You got your AP and a light every room.
I mean, I think if they just stick with whatever it is that they're doing, you know, they'll get through it. You know, I think that was M5's biggest failure is that they stick with it. You know, people have different opinions on it, but, you know, from my usage of M5, my only problem was that it just didn't have a big enough box. You know, they built all the box building initially, and then that was it.
Yeah.
You know, they didn't do anything after that.
I had some demo models of it, and for me, the downside was the software wasn't robust enough. It didn't have enough if then else capabilities, right? You couldn't really, outside of the handful of things they gave you, there wasn't a lot of control you could exert. I mean, you couldn't utilize the information you were collecting in any kind of meaningful way, you know? So if I was detecting a certain condition, I couldn't really do anything customized with it. Maybe I could send a notification, but even that notification, I couldn't put a lot of variables on it. Like if it's this time of day and the temperature's outside and you see this thing, you know, I mean, you couldn't get it as granular as I would have liked. It seemed like they were maybe going to head in that direction, but I don't know, just for whatever reason, they scrapped it.
For my use case, it was monitoring, just recording what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe do an alert if it exceeds a threshold, but that was it, you know, irrespective of time or relative variables, just throw an alert if this exceeds. Pretty basic.
Yeah.
I just wanted a bigger box.
Oh, with more ports? Yeah. Fair enough. All right, so moving on with some more of the hardware stuff. You linked to the FCC, application for the Microtik HAP AC2. So that's actually Wave 2 AC chipset in a HAP. Did it actually show any pictures in there? I'm not sure what the case looks like. I'm hoping that it's that new slick black kind of tower mount case.
It looks as though pictures are being held at this time. With the FCC, when you as you do these filings, you can label them as, you know, confidential with some expiry date. So I usually put those sorts of dates when when they plan to actually have it shipping. You know, they have a they then release that information. Nothing in there now.
Gotcha. But, well, if it's making it through the FCC, I guess we can expect an announcement pretty soon. Andrew Thrift has his own speculations, but I'll let him be the one to put that stuff out there. I'm really looking forward to this, especially on the price point. Hopefully it's not $130 for an access point the way the existing HAP AC is. I love the HAP AC. It's got a lot of power, a lot of kick. Antenna configuration is really nice. It has 5 gig ports. It's got the USB port, but it's got like a $120 price tag or something like that. And it's just crazy insane when you compare it to the AC Lite. It is about $44 somewhere in the neighborhood. So it's nearly 3 times the price. Of course, the AC Lites only have a 100 meg port. I really wish they had a gig port. That's really what I want. I want AC and I want a gig port, and I don't want to pay an arm and a leg. And it would be super nice if it was AFAT compliant, right? Some kind of compliant PoE as well. I'd love to use dirt cheap Cisco switches. I mean, you can get like a 3550, a Cisco 3550 48 porter for $40 in its PoE. So I'd love to get one of those babies to power these guys. Of course, that's only going to be 100 meg ports. So if it was kind of a light version, that would do. But I can still get something in the $120 range for Cisco that would do 48 ports a gig PoE. So I would love to see that. I'm not going to hold my breath because I really don't think it'll be a compliant PoE on there, but you never know, right? Do these things hold any interest to you? You any interest in these things? I know I'm really interested in. I know Cox is really interested in.
Yeah, they hold the most interest from me for a Microtik wireless product is something like that.
Okay.
A home, you know, access point router combination. You know, they always find a way to neuter it in some, you know, it's like, this is exactly what I want, except this one thing. So, like, you know, I've looked at some stuff from, like, IgniteNet, things like that. You know, because I'm trying to break into a couple, like, you know, into the MDU space with as many MDUs as are in the Chicago metro, avoiding downtown because there's so much competition there. You'd think I'd be able to get somebody, but no. But, like, I was looking at just something to, like, just mount, you know, in an apartment, you know, does dual band, you know, can do an actual gigabit of throughput, which I know is difficult on wireless, but
it's hard to sell. On my next MDU project, the one that's coming up in here pretty soon, I'm going to be doing the AC lights based on that project. I'm just going to do the AC lights. So it's only 100 megs to the AP, but I don't know. Oversubscription ratios, it should be okay, I think. Because I'm not going to be doing kind of a gig to the individual residents, so I'll be able to ride that for a while. If I eventually have to do a refresh, so be it. So that's what I'm looking at. I'm also excited for these things, too, because that kind of Microtik cloud control software stuff, my programming partner, he's gotten pretty far along with it. He's actually got it to where it's exerting some control over the Microtiks. The interface looks really good. So I'm hoping we'll have something we can actually get people hooked up on here pretty soon, outside of just, you know, running in the lab sort of scenario. It's pretty cool. We've added a couple of really interesting features. I don't want to let the cat out of the bag. I sort of want to present it all at once, but I'm excited about it and excited to force you and the rest of the guys on the Slack to be my guinea pigs.
As a tangent, on the FCC report, they do have a photo of it appears to be like a vertical standing piece, because there's a photo of the sticker that's on the bottom of the foot. Doesn't actually show anything. It's just the bottom of the base.
Is it clear plastic?
Black. This looks like a black rubbery thing. They do have what might be a picture. It's hard to tell because like in the FCC certs, they could have, you know, non-production or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, devices, but I do see something that's a black rectangle-ish, about 5 inches by 5 inches. It says half AC squared. So that could be it. It could be, you know, there's that. It isn't a great picture. Be it. There's, you know, there's no lights, no ports, no nothing, so I can't be certain. I out the actual model number, not half AC squared. It is the Microtik BD52G-5HACD2HND-TC.
Of course it is.
And if I was current on what those letters meant, I would know exactly what it could do.
I'm sure Giannis would love to explain or send you a link to where it shows all that stuff. I think they put a wiki article together that gave you a decoder ring for all of those things.
It, you know, it's high powered, it's AC, it's 5 gig, and it's 2 gig, gigabit Ethernet. The D is new to me. Sure, well, there's three D's in here. I'm not sure what those all mean.
Extra D's for a double dose of pimping. let's see. So while we're talking about Microtik, I was doing a BGP project for a guy not too long ago, a guy overseas, and he has CCR 1016s. He's got three of those in production, two in one data center, and then one in another one. And one of them, he's got, I think, two upstream providers, and he's also hitting an internet exchange. I want to say he's got like a total of 8 to 12 peers somewhere in there. And on this router, he's got over 1.3 million routes on it. And I have never seen a CCR hold that many routes. And needless to say, one of the procs is always at 100%. Right, and you look at system profile, and it's like routing, just hammering it, you know. And if you watch it, it's interesting because it'll jump around different processors, right? It'll sit on a proc for a while, and then it'll move to another one. But yeah, whenever I was watching it, there was no one point in time where that processor wasn't at 100% CPU. It was kind of blowing me away. But he was passing traffic just fine. It seemed like it was doing okay. He was having some oddities where I think like at random intervals. No, it could have been the upstream. I'm not going to say it wasn't the upstream, but at random intervals, it would quit accepting his outbound advertisements, or he quit sending outbound advertisements, one or the other. Or maybe the router, I don't know, right? Who knows? When you've got that many routes and the CPU's just, you know, burning at the temperature of the surface of the sun, who really knows what's going on there? But we added some redundancy in through some other cares and stuff. I was just curious, have you ever heard of anybody running that many routes on a CCR?
I'm looking at a CCR that I've got access to now. See how many routes it's got.
It actually converged. It seemed like it was converging fairly efficiently. I mean, well, I think it would take 2 to 5 minutes to fully converge those, which is surprisingly not bad, I thought. I don't know. When we peered all the rest of them together, I didn't want to, because he's got like three other upstreams, and I didn't want all of those routes to kind of tip over. So if you have 1.3 million routes on all of those, I was just afraid what it was going to do. So we did some filtering in between on the IBGP process. We actually cut out anything that was /21 or smaller in between the peers. So you're going to lose, you know, a decent bit of the efficiency, especially if you're going to an internet exchange. A lot of your routes are going to be really small ones, which is why you had so many routes sitting on those on that one router. But you're still going to get some load sharing in between, you know, outbound, and you still get the redundancy of if one peer fails, it'll still kick over to the others outbound.
Yeah.
It was kind of the only compromise that I could sort of think of that would not kill all of his infrastructure, you know, because on that one router that has 1.3 million, if somebody decided to start cycling up and down, I'm pretty sure that router is going to tip over. So I didn't want that taking out the rest of his infrastructure. So this is the only kind of feasible way I could think about it. Because his other ones, I mean, even though they've got a full route table at about 660,000 routes, they're not doing too bad. You know, I mean, with that many routes, there's always some amount of churn. I mean, there's always a little bit changing here and there, but it's not completely killing the routers. Now, in the 1.3 million routes, yeah, that amount of churn is keeping it at 100%, but it's still passing traffic. Still routing.
This one it had 1,460,892. Well, plus some. You know, I didn't add up all the little peers. I just added, you know, the two transits and the, you know, changes. That's, you know, V4 and V6. CPU that has the routing on it is almost always running high 90s, which if I remember, it used to always run 100. So they're getting better.
That's good. I mean, you gotta give it to MikroTik. It seems like the newest revisions of Router OS have been the most stable, I think, that I can really remember. You know, the last several revisions.
Well, when you spend 6 years on the same version, it should get pretty stable.
I don't want to hear it. I'm living in the now. Like, I'm living with what I got. I'm not going to lament the fact that there's not a new version.
As I keep watching here, like, it just dipped down to like 50%. So like, I'm like on the core that's doing the routing. So like, I'm like really surprised. I mean, it's back up to 95 now, but I'm really surprised to see the CCR is not sitting at a million, you know, 100% on that core. MikroTik, when you have route filters and you're dropping stuff, does the prefix column in the peer window, does it show you what you're being sent or what you're accepting?
It's what you're getting from that neighbor. It's the routes received from them. If you want to look at what you're advertising, okay, so you have to go to the advertising menu, but it's usually better to do it from the command line. It's like more intelligible.
Well, sure. Yeah. Yeah. I was just making sure that, like, you know, just curious that, you know, if you're filtering anything under a 21, you know, does that show up there? Cause obviously it's too much, jumping the command line is gonna take you quite a while.
So if you're like if you do IP route print where static, just trying to find what out the which static IPs they actually have, or rather which static routing is in use, it takes a little while to churn when you've got that many routes. It takes a little bit to return. I'm talking like a minute plus sometimes. But something else, I was talking to another customer, they were saying, you know, I want to build as many nines as I can in, but obviously I want to do it as cheaply as possible, right? It's the conundrum everybody always seems to find themselves in. So I was like, well, if we didn't do MikroTik, what could we do? And so I was thinking, what could you do? What's the cheapest thing you could do to get a lot of port density and be able to do some stuff? And I was thinking, you know, I'm a Cisco guy. I know you're going to roll your eyes. You're going to say whatever it is you got to say, but I've been using Cisco stuff for a long time. So, and I've been using Catalyst stuff for a long time, like the 6500 series stuff. And so I was thinking, how cheap could you build a redundant
furnace?
Hey, man, don't knock them, brother. They run and they run and they run. They're tough. Pinch, boat anchor. You're good.
Are you friends with Kevin Meyer on Facebook?
I don't know, man. I don't really get on Facebook anymore.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, you don't go to the bridge. Like last week was like it was really cold in Mississippi, Alabama, wherever it is that he's at, and like he posted a picture of a 6500 saying that he had turned down, you know, on his 6500 to get enough heat in his house or the office or whatever it was. I was like, yeah, that's, they're good for that.
Yeah, you might be more efficient just getting a space heater, but they do. All right. So they aren't the most power efficient thing out there. I mean, this is a product line that's been around 15, 20 years. I mean, they've been around a long time, and they're actually still producing new stuff, like the soup. What is it? A2 or T2 or whatever the newest thing is. I can't.
Soup 2T was the newest one a few years ago.
There you go. See? They made a new one. So that's, yeah, they're 2T. There you go. So that's amazing. Something that's 20 years old, and they're still producing line cards that shove into it. I mean, I guess that should go towards saying something about the chassis and the longevity of it. But you can get a 6504, so that's a 4-slot chassis with 2 redundant power supplies. You can get 2 Soup 723 BXL processors, right? So those redundant soups, so they can fail over. You can do in-service software updates, so you can upgrade one line card or one supervisor and then fail over to him and then do the other one, right? So it's basically a hitless upgrade, hitless failover as well. Non-stop forwarding on those chassis, so you can lose a soup and you're not going to drop a packet, which is pretty cool. Then you got a couple of line cards in there. You could do a 10 gig line card and then a 48 port or let's say 24 port SFP line card, right? So you got 10 gig, you can do combinations of things right there, and that setup shipped is like $1,500. So that's not bad for that level of redundancy. Now you can steal everything from the IPv6 route table, force that over to IPv4. So you can get a million routes of IPv4 on this thing. And the line cards support 40 gigs of throughput. So you can technically route 40 gigs out of this thing. So that's a lot of beef, you know, if you want to get right down to it, for $1,500 being able to route that stuff. And it's going to be in high available scenario, you know, and I'm sure, I just don't know anything about Juniper stuff. I'm not that Juniper guy, so I'm curious what kind of an equivalent Juniper chassis would look like.
I'm trying to think, because they've got the MXs, which are, you know, the current, you know, big dogs, but they've been around a while. I don't know if before the MXs they were, I mean, I know they had like the M, like, you know, they are like the M, M10i, because a client of mine has one, but like, I would assume something in the middle, because like that M10i was like, it maxed out at like 6 gigs of throughput, but, and then like an MX240 will take 100 gig, like, multi-port 100 gig line cards. So it's like there's something in between. What? I don't know.
I hear you.
But you know, but those MX, you know, 240s, 480s, 960s, they've been around a long time too. Not as long as a 6500, I would say, but
yeah. I was looking at like the ASRs too, the Cisco ASRs, and those are like routers, you know what I mean? It's like when you say router, that's what you think of. You're thinking of the ASR stuff, and I was looking at the ASR 1001 XH, I think, which is kind of a newer one, older-ish. I don't know. Anyway, it's newer. It's interesting. They like kind of license the throughput is apparently what it looks like, but it's a 1U little pizza box. It's got, I don't know, like 6 gig ports, I think, or it's like SFP plus or something like that. Anyway, those things retail for like $25,000 on eBay, which is incredible. And then if you look at the older ASRs that I think do, I don't know, like 10 gigs of throughput or something like that, those are retailing for like $5,000. So that's a pretty big discrepancy when you're looking at all that stuff. Plus, the ASRs are super license centric. You know what I mean? Like, everything's a license. This is a license, that's a license. Whereas the Catalyst series is still kind of the, you get everything, licensing model, kind of the older style, so I like it a little better, plus the throughput that's there. But it's not, I mean, the routing engine's not as strong in the Catalyst stuff. Like on those ASRs, I think the 1000, anything with an X after it, if you throw like 8 gigs of RAM in there, it starts at like a million IPv4 and a million IPv6 routes. And the fact that the internet route table is getting to that nearly 700,000 route mark means, you know, that's in the foreseeable future, you're going to need that many routes. And if you look at, yeah, like the guy I was working with, it's on that exchange, he already needs, you know, 1.25+ million routes. Your client right there already had over 1 million routes. So that day is here for some people.
That I was doing some, you know, tab complete on that CCR. IP only will tell you how many routes you have on your table, and it executes in, I mean, mm-hmm. a second.
Yeah, half yeah, a second. Count only. Yeah, yeah, it's really fast.
And so there's some duplication there, so that they end up whittling down to 1,358,000 when all said and done. And then the Cat 6500 came out in 99. The MX series came out in 2006.
That's crazy. 99. I was still in high school. I was a little ways back. Yeah. And I mean, I don't remember which mom it was or whatever, but I remember MikroTik talking about the BGP improvements they had in the new version 7 code that they were playing with, and they showed just these insane optimizations. Theoretically, with the same hardware.
It was the Pittsburgh bum.
Oh, God, that feels like it was forever ago. It was like 2 years ago.
2014. I know, because I just looked up in the past like 2 weeks. It was still in my YouTube search history. I found exactly the spot in the video where Jan starts talking about, you know, BGP performance of the CCR and what the new platform will do. And
yeah, but requires the newer code, which we don't have access to. So, I mean, it goes to show you the platform they have now is capable. You know, the Tyler stuff that's in there can do it. We just need that optimized code. So everybody out there with these CCRs, I mean, your 1.3 million routes is going to work right, or not necessarily work. It theoretically works right now, but it's going to work far more efficiently in the future, hopefully.
Yeah, I haven't seen it myself yet, but I hear that the Ubiquiti Infinity Edge router, one that has all the 10 gig ports on it, mm-hmm. I hear that it can, you know, that's a full table in a respectable time frame. You know, it's not x86 fast, but it's, you know, fast DR. And that's, you know, that's a WISP type focused router, mm-hmm. that has multiple 10 gig ports. You know, acceptable performance. I'd probably, not having seen it myself, but that's another option.
I've seen one. I've never played with it.
We actually got one for Indianapolis to kind of help with, as we're turning up more CDNs, we need more capacity, because not all the CDNs want to be directly on the exchange. Some want to be within somebody else's AS. So then you handle everything twice. lots of 10 gig ports to handle things, and so the CCR was kind of chugging along, so we thought we'd give this other guy a try. It hasn't been implemented yet, else I'd maybe next couple of casts I'll see how that works, but you know, I fall back to, in comparison, you know, one of my clients, I, you know, they had that old Juniper M10i. I moved them over to a CHR, run and VMware on an old single socket Xeon, like and it's running a bunch of other stuff on the server as well, and like its CPU usage for routing is like 5%, and it jumps up to like 30 or 40 every now and then, but it's usually chugging along there really low. I'm like, this server can't cost more than $200. You had to buy new. Well, not new, but to buy today. The server can't cost more than $200.
Right. Yeah, I mean,
it's like, what do you got? Bring it.
I know you can get like, what is it, like the HP, what are they, like the DL380s or whatever? Like the Gen 5, 6 of those things or whatever, and they're dirt cheap. I have a couple of those. I actually have one sitting on the desk right behind me, and it is whisper quiet. But they have a lot of horsepower, and they are, golly, yeah, they're a couple $100 off of eBay with everything you need already in there. And if you're just running it bare MikroTik, you don't need it loaded up with a ton of hard drives. You could do it with something solid state in there. And then if you are running Proxmox or VMware, yeah, it's going to be so low load on that device that you're going to be able to do a lot of different things. So
yeah,
CHRs can handle BGP a lot better than the CCRs seem to right now. So if you're looking for something a little beef, need a whole lot of routes, I guess that's a good option for you.
Yeah, I would suspect that, and we may have talked about this before on the cast. I know we've talked about it in Slack and on the phone with a few people. And I hope it just wasn't just two shows ago that we talked about it, or that I talked about it, but I would suspect that if you ran an x86 MikroTik, you know, CHR, whatever, at the provider edge, that you could probably do your CCRs with IBGP in the middle, and they could probably handle it because they're not taking the entire internet, you know, changes. You know, it's just getting, you know, what do you need to know that has changed versus everybody's changes.
Yeah, there's gonna be fewer fluctuations because the edge routers, they're gonna have to be everything's gonna have to be full mesh, and I guess they'll still, well, I don't know, I mean, there's still gonna be a bit of churn there. I guess if you could limit their tables a little bit and your edges have if you could do direct connects between your edges, then they can, you know, you could unoptimally route to router one, and then if he has a direct connect to a router two, he can then shoot it across that wire and it'll go where it needs to go. So I mean, there's a lot of different things you could do if you have to make it work. Yeah, and I've had to do that in so many different scenarios with Cisco and MikroTik and everything else.
Yeah, you know, it's a thought. I haven't tried it yet, but I would think it'd be less because you're not having to do, like, you know, I'm talking like you've got like an, you know, IBGP router, you know, within your network. For some reason, it has full. You've got, you know, disparate edges. You know, I would think it would have less work to do because your edges are chewing everything that's happening, and then it's just getting.
Yeah, I mean, they're constantly churning. So, like, your edge router, if from, say, edge router one, if he gets an update from a provider and it's a new route or an updated route from that edge provider, he's going to check his route table, check the computations. If it's not best path to that subnet, nothing changes. So just he incurs the CPU hit. Nobody else does. Because that's the good thing about BGP is, well, good and bad sometimes, is that every BGP router is going to look at what's best path, and that's the only thing it's going to tell everybody else. So even if you know it happens to have the same route, but for whatever reason, he's determined, you know, I'm not best path. You know, even if it's equal cost, there's equal cost multipath. He's going to go through the decision-making process, and ultimately, he's going to pick one route. So there's kind of not really that load balance concept. Usually you can get around that in BGP. So Yeah, I guess it would, in theory, cut down on the computations if you just had, say, gateway routers inside that were IBGP peered to your backbones. They're going to take less of a hit. And that's true. I see that even on my Cisco kit, because I have border routers that terminate my peers, and then those pull back to gateways, and the gateways are what I hang all of my customers off of. And they generally are, I don't know, 5 to 20% lower on CPU utilization, I think, somewhere in that neighborhood, even though it's basically the same procs, same everything.
Chrome lost one of my windows. I don't know where my TVW topics stand.
All right, well, the next thing on the list that we had was IPv6. You put that on there. What's the big push for IPv6, Mike?
It's better, so do it.
You know, I just saw something on the Nanog list that popped through, and they were talking about Hulu having problems with MTU issues, and they were saying, and it was kind of an interesting little article. They were talking about path discovery and how you know, you shouldn't obviously block path discovery. We've talked about this multiple times. Don't block path. There's a handful of ICMP messages that you should not block, and path discovery is one of them. But they were talking about with IPv6, they had to end up setting their MTU down to like 1260, I think, or 1280 across the board for any IPv6 packets that are coming through, because a lot of that is doing, you know, tunneling of some sort. You know, it's 6-4 or 6-4-6 XLAT or whatever it happens to be, and so it kind of screws up the MTU stuff. But they said initially why it became a problem is they changed their internal infrastructure to do ECMP, equal cost multipathing, and so sometimes your connection might go in and go to the left, you know, because they have tons of load balancers, so it might come in and go to the left to you know, to server one over here, but then you're having MTU issues, and so the ICMP that would get sent back from your client would actually get load balanced to a completely different server, so the original server wouldn't know to readjust the MTU, and so they just started having like these blanket problems across. And so that was pretty interesting. So it's not always easy just to say go to IPv6. There's still we still got some growing pains. I mean, there's still some stuff out there that's not necessarily super friendly.
There's still some network admins that are just shutting up IPv6 and moving all that TKM over to V4 routes.
I have no idea what you're talking about. Some of us aren't made of money, Mike, and they've got to do what they got to do.
Now, with a couple polls that I created just to see where you know, WISPs are in things, you know, stages of, you've got your own allocation, you've deployed some of it, and you know, you're entirely V6, you know, whether that's V6 only or, you know, dual stack, I don't really care. Where this helps is, you know, as V4 addresses get more expensive to purchase, more people are looking at, okay, well, I need to implement some sort of NAT solution. Well, NAT always breaks shit, whether it's a home NAT or a carrier grade NAT or a ghetto carrier grade NAT done on MikroTik, which is what I would do if I were in that situation. It always breaks something, you know, whether it's consoles can't appropriately reach out if you're not running you, which if you're running, if the service provider is running NAT, you know, UPVP doesn't daisy chain, you know, so that, you know, you're going to have issues with that. You know, if you got V6 going, you then not only have rid yourself of those problems, you know, your Xboxes are getting out because, you know, they have a public address. It's a V6 address, but still a public address. And the bulk of your content, you know, the bulk of your traffic will probably be on V6 because Netflix and Google and Facebook and on and on and on, you know,
like Amazon and Cloudflare and all those guys. Yeah.
Yeah. Like, you know, they're all running V6. So then it solves net problems, but then it reduces your load on your net routers.
All right. Can I ask you a question, Mike? Are you running IPv6?
No. on the IXVR, on my client, I'm rolling it in. On mine, my upstream didn't support it, and my new upstream does. And so it was just get the BGP sessions turned up, and it's just I'm waiting. I have it configured. I have my space. I'm just waiting for them. No, the old upstream didn't do it, and I got one that did. So just waiting for that to get put in place. Apparently, they don't really like it when you just send them a copy of code for the just paste this into the console of the router, and then I can get to work. They don't like it when you do that.
No, I wouldn't care for that.
don't take months to get me what I want, and I don't have to tell you how to do your job, and then wait even longer because now you're mad at me. We have V6 on the exchange. You know, I encourage people on exchange to do, to do V6. I saw another post on V6, this World IPv6 Launch Day. It's been a thing for a few years.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like probably about 75% of the traffic from, U.S. mobile carriers is done over V6 now instead of, 76. So if you don't have, it's easier if you're doing, if you're managing the router for your client, whether that's a managed Wi-Fi service or you're just doing, NAT on your CPE, it's easier for you to pass six through because then you're not worried about them running a, 54G back there that doesn't even do 5 megs, much less V6. That's something you can do. You can get, three quarters of your traffic over V6. That was just yesterday that they made that post. There's just lots of talk I've seen about, there's guys that are buying, slash 21s at a time, and, those are getting to be $30,000 now. And it's like, okay, well, when you spend $30,000 to get IP addresses, you start to wonder if there's maybe a better way of doing things. If you've got two or three or four of those slash 21s already, you get to thinking, do I buy another one or do I roll out V6, do some, CG NAT for the stuff that's still on 4, and then sell some of these 21s that I have that I don't need anymore?
I don't know, man. It's like your Bitcoin, right? How long should I squat on this before it's at maximum price? And let's not talk about Bitcoin. What is it? What's the joke? It's like a vegan, a guy who runs marathons, and a guy who trades Bitcoins walk into a bar. Who tells you about it first?
I used to see updates from people all the time about, oh my God, it's people high. Oh my God, it's up to this now. And then things got quiet, and then I heard that it really dove. And yeah, we're down to 12,000. I think it was up to 20 something at one point.
That's cool. Whatever. It's like I can't gamble. There's a part of my brain where it just, it just gives me anxiety and makes me I can't stand it. So it's like that's all that stuff is, it's just like gambling. You're guessing, you're playing a game of chance with your money. And I get there's some skill associated with it, but I don't have the time or inclination to figure it out. So we are right at the hour mark. You want to stick a fork in it, Mikey?
Oh shit. What do you mean?
I know we never get to anything and we always hit the hour.
Just a couple minutes on this other one.
All right, what's the other one?
eDNS. I didn't realize Wilson had made the post about this until I was going through my RSS feeds and saw this. And I've heard about it a few times, but I was re-engaged by it by looking through some of the documentation for one of the VMs we're working with. What eDNS does is it basically, it runs on your resolvers, and like how we're always telling you that you need to run your DS or your DNS resolvers within your network VMs work properly, eDNS is a step towards fixing that problem, because it's some other addition onto the DNS protocol where it will pass the original requester's IP address to the authoritative server. So then the authoritative server then knows not the IP address of the resolving server asking it, but the original requester. So then it then, then the CDN can use that information in its decision-making process as to where to send you traffic from. You know, it used to always use the IP address of the resolver. Some of them now support that extension that gets you the IP address of the actual requester, public of the requester. And so then that, not all CDNs support it, so you to have a DNS resolver on your network for optimal performance.
Is this for geolocation or whatever? So like if I happen to be in Texas, it's going to find the nearest server to me based on the IP that it's requesting? Is that the idea?
Well, geo is a part of it, but then also, network telemetry. So, they do tests to different, subnets and things. When it was the resolving DNS request, they would have history of performance to that DNS server from various nodes in the area. So it will pick whichever node is closest to you network-wise as well. Not ASNs, best to you network-wise. Not just ASN count, not just hop count, not just late. Consistency of good latency. It has all that information, data that they've collected over time to figure out which node is the best node to serve you with. Why having the resolving DNS server on the other side of the country doesn't help, because, Google's, if you're in Texas, your DNS server's in LA, they're going to serve you out of the LA node, and you're not going to, whereas they might have a Dallas better for you. But anyways, this, eDNS is just another tool to help kind of make it easier to get the right information. Some of those public DNS servers support that. Some of them don't. Some, resolvers that you implement on your networks support it. Some of them don't. To look into it, ask questions. I don't know if he did much more than just post a link to the RFC on it, but it started a conversation, so I guess it did its job.
Yeah, I see it talking about being a draft. I didn't know that it was actually in use yet, but I guess maybe it is. Because here's some bind information on it, I guess.
It
says bind has been shipping with eDNS enabled by default for over a decade. So it's probably there and enabled.
Just check, make sure everything's working right on that. There's various confidentiality things with the CDNs and stuff, that they give to us, but I can't stress enough proper DNS, resolution locations and support to them. One of them says, if your resolver is not in a prefix that's being sent to us from the exchange, you don't get served from the exchange. So that's important.
Sounds like. All right, Mikey, you ready now?
I suppose.
All right. So if people are going to get a hold of you, Mike Kamet, out on the internet, how do they do that?
PayPal.
PayPal.com. It's his website. He's a big fan of it.
I was just trying to think of a funnier way of saying I'm really busy, so don't. But if you send me money, I will. You've got my attention.
That's the idea. Whenever you get busy, you just raise your rates. That's the idea.
I got busy. I raised my rates, and then I realized I didn't raise them enough. So the next person to ask is going to get like 50% more than the last guy, because apparently I wasn't charging enough.
And that's the way it goes, man. You don't turn them away; they turn themselves away.
But Facebook, LinkedIn, Twitter, Google+, as Greg always says, I'm the one that pretty much runs the relative social media stuff. So reaching out to us there, it's me. I guess on my preferred way, also, other than PayPal, is the Little Brothers Slack chat. Available exclusively to Patreon supporters of Village Wisp.
That's right. You can find that at patreon.com/TheBrothersWisp. We've got a handful of really active guys in there, man. I really have been enjoying it. Normally I mute my Slack channels, but this one I've been leaving open just because there's so much good discourse going on in there. A lot of good ideas being thrown around, and I don't know. I've been really enjoying it.
I had brought it up then just because, just as that happened, Slack have popped up. Somebody else had said something, so in that chat, looks like we've got 17 people in there now. Lots of people talking about lots of things. It's kind of nice when at the beginning it was just I still enjoyed it, but it was people asking us questions, but now there's enough people in there where you've got dialogue amongst other supporters, some of it conflicts, some of it doesn't, but everybody's there helping everybody.
It's killer. It just that knowledge pool, it just keeps getting bigger and bigger. That's that's how this podcast started, actually. In the beginning is a collection of all these people with different specialized knowledges, in all these different areas. And how do you kind of put them all together? Let's have, every so often we sit down and talk. Well, why don't we record that and put it up for everybody else? Maybe they'd find it interesting. And so there you go. And so this just adds to that kind of resource pool. It's that much more knowledge and experience built in there. I love it, man. A lot of good different perspectives. Because in there, we've got people from all different walks of lives, different technologies. So they're going to take a different slant on everything. So, just about anything, there's multiple ways of doing the same thing. Sometimes a little bit better than others. And sometimes somebody's done it in a way you may have never thought about. So it turns out really well. It's kind of like when you go to the Wispapalooza show. There's just a whole bunch of people that have done similar things in a lot of different ways. And so you get a lot of different knowledge. Different perspectives. It's really nice. But this way you can just hit somebody 24/7 really fast on the keyboard and get a good response.
I was just checking the analytics, and over the past week we've had between 5 and 11 active daily users making posting there's a good variety of people chatting away.
It's killer. It's killer.
Oddly enough, New Year, nobody posted anything, apparently.
I was busy. I was indisposed.
Two people checked in to see what was going on, but nobody said anything.
Such is life. That's the way it goes.
Apparently, we have lives outside of this.
No, I don't. So if you want to find me outside of this, you can find me on gregsoul.com. where I very occasionally blog, and there's still a lot of old information, some of it good. If you want to email me, it's greg@gregsoul.com. Really easy to find and contact. Again, the Facebook page, facebook.com/thebrotherswisp, all that good information that's coming from Mikey here. He's Johnny on the spot. He's been really busy, but it seems like you're kind of getting your life back a bit, so a little bit more responsive. Yeah, we do have that Patreon. We mentioned that. I guess if you have any questions or comments, fire them our way. We want to hear about it. I think that's about it, right?
I guess we can maybe mention two things. Just talk about them. One, we're trying to do age and different schedules here. Obviously, I'm kind of monotonous with just Greg and I and the occasional visitor. Not that I don't mind Greg's company, but, as Greg says, we're trying to find other schedules where we have maybe alternating schedules, different guys, different times. Just try to get more engagement from our side. And I believe Greg said also that we finally have, enough contributions where, to solve some of your complaints, I'll get a real microphone. So then you won't hear this.
Oh, but I love it when it sounds like you're eating potato chips on the cast. It's great. All right. Well, everybody, thank you again. Questions, comments, fire them away. And thank you so much for listening all the way to the end. You few, the brave that make it this far. Thanks, guys. Bye.
See ya.